The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to our Tuesday evening Space Show program. Great to be here. Thank you all for tuning in. And we're gonna have a really interesting, informative show because I've read our guest's book, which I'll tell you about in a minute, so I know what is in store for us. So, announcements. Our toll-free number for those of you who would like to call, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Do let it ring until it can be answered. Be patient. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. If you're outside the U.S. and your country allows you to make toll-free calls to the United States, remember that our toll-free number is an MCI number. So get a hold of your in-country MCI operator, and that operator should be able to connect you to this number. And if you are in a country that does not permit toll-free calls, and you still want to call in, email me, and I will give you the regular phone number and area code and country code. But you would have to call on your own call because we don't have the capability of taking collect calls on that line. But we do want to hear from you. But if you do insist on email, the addresses are all up and running tonight, but you might as well just use the one, drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then do remember we're podcasting, and you can find our RSS URL to subscribe to our podcast on our website, both of our newsletters, and also after the fact as an archive program. You'll find the podcast in iTunes, Microsoft's Zune, Podcast Alley, AstroSpaceNow.com, YAstro.com, and a host of other places as well. So if you do have any questions about the podcast, do let me hear from you. Be happy to answer them. Just send a note to drspace@thespaceshow.com. And do remember also that everything we do is copyrighted and trademarked, but you do have permission to download these programs and to distribute them and share them in the MP3 file format. Do not edit the programs. Don't do anything commercial. And transcripts are not permitted, even if you're making them for your own personal use. In fact, I'm going to talk about this at some length tomorrow during our special Open Lines program. If you have an idea for how you would like to use or work with this particular Space Show program, email me. Be glad to hear your idea and discuss it with you. Very open-minded here. So, again, Dr. Space at thespaceshow.com. And then do visit our website, which is thespaceshow.com. Our comprehensive newsletter is up usually by Sunday evening, California time. And that comprehensive newsletter has all of the details of the week's programming, the full details on the guest bios, and it's the only place you'll find a future events or what's upcoming for the Space Show. And then if we have to change our schedule, make announcements or anything like that, that website newsletter is where you're going to find it first. You can also subscribe to the email, very short newsletter off of our website. You can't miss the links to it. And it goes out early Monday morning, California time, by email, or just send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived, and you can go back to 2001 and hear every single one of our show, except for two of them. That's another story. And you can easily download these shows as well. There's a Space Show store. Check it out. You'll see it up at the top. It's called Space Show Gear. And then, again, the most important part of that website probably is the Support the Space Show button. We are a nonprofit 501c3 with One Giant Leap Foundation. And this program only exists because some of you out there do donate to us and are very generous about that. We would not exist unless we had your contributions. End of story. Very simple. So please do consider donating to the space show. If you pay U.S. taxes, you do get a tax deduction because we are a nonprofit. And if you pay California taxes, you will also get a deduction as we are a California public benefit corporation. If you have any questions about that, send me the note at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And then finally, the last part of the announcements. Do remember that the Space Show is brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. And please do visit their website for more of their information and their really incredible panels and programming. They are at the cutting edge. SecureWorldFoundation.org. So, listeners, tonight I'm very happy to introduce all of you to Mark Kaufman. Mr. Kaufman is a science writer and national editor at the Washington Post, and he has a new book out called First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. And let me read you what he says about how he wrote this book and his search. To report First Contact, Mr. Kaufman spent more than 2 years traveling the globe to meet and learn from the scientists at the cutting edge of the search for life beyond Earth. The world of ET had not been a major interest of his over the years, although he was certainly a fan of 2001, A Space Odyssey, but was pulled in during a science-religion fellowship, we'll have to ask him about that, and had come to see the search as far more than a curiosity. In fact, he came to see the worldwide effort to learn extraterrestrial life as a kind of stealth Apollo program, a massive in-scope yet hidden in plain view. As a reporter and editor for more than 30 years, mostly at the Washington Post and the Philadelphia Inquirer, Kaufman has been primed to jump on the big story. And that's what he saw in astrobiology. But he believes his years working as a foreign correspondent trained him best to write this book. Why? His task was again to learn and understand new languages and cultures, only this time of a scientific nature. He also needed to find the individuals who might best bring the work and the story to life, and then to translate their research for those without their depth of training and experience. It was the education of a lifetime, and hopefully will be eye-opening and compelling for you. And I can tell you, after having read his book, it is eye-opening and compelling. Mark Kaufman, welcome to the Space Show. And when you were learning all these languages, did you learn Klingon?
I did not, alas. And thank you so much for having me on here. I'm really delighted to be on. And I look forward to speaking, talking to your listeners about all that I learned and some of the remarkable scientists that I came across.
So starting out, I mean, I read a little bit in your introductory bio about why you did this, but you got interested in this in a science religion fellowship. I mean, what really grabbed you to put you on a 2-year traveling search about ET?
There was some antecedent to that. When I became a full-time science and space writer at the Post, I definitely had a lot of experience with reporting, but not a whole lot with science. Some, but not nearly what I needed. And so I went up to an MIT science writing boot camp sponsored by the Knight Foundation, and it was on the universe. And we were going to learn everything that there was about the universe in 3 or 4 days, I believe. And it was, in fact, a remarkable collection of speakers who came to talk to us. The one who really stood out for me was a woman named Sarah Seeger, who is a quite well-known astrophysicist now and is a specialist in exoplanets and their atmospheres. And she's a young woman, was the youngest woman, youngest person ever to become a tenured, chaired professor at MIT. She was a tender age of 34 when this happened. And so she got up in front of us and she said, you know, in our lifetimes, we will find life beyond Earth. And I responded not so much as a scientist, but rather as a reporter, which was to say, boy, what a terrific story. And from there, I started to do the science reporting, but also had the good fortune to get a Templeton, Cambridge fellowship, which brought me over to Cambridge, UK for a number of months, where I really started to grapple with some of the science and then also some of the implications of where that science was headed. In the process, the idea became a book, or a book idea, a proposal, and then it became a contract, and before I knew it, there I was off taking a year and a half leave and traveling around the world to talk to all these folks. So it was a real kind of eye-opening for me, one, to hear people who were such experts in the fields and had such strong credentials to be saying something as remarkable as we're going to find life beyond Earth, you know, in our lifetimes. And then, two, to be able to really begin the process of understanding both the history of that debate and the context of the debate, and then all of that then blossomed into the science of it.
So let me rule out something up front for our discussion, because I know, and this is probably sacrosanct to the real science community, but the New Age community, let's just call it New Age to be polite, mm-hmm. has a huge interest and perspective about extraterrestrial life that is radically different from the real science community. I mean, you know, we're constantly in touch with our cousins in the Pleiades, and you let your imagination run wild, right? Your trips, you didn't go to shamans or any of the New Age gurus or any of the sort of outside the mainstream science world for anything dealing with extraterrestrial, correct?
I did not. I mean, I was at the Vatican for an astrobiology conference. And
they're very scientific. They're not Looney Tunes at all.
Right. And they do indeed have their an observatory there in the Southwest. But other than that, no. What I did was talk to people in the fields of, you know, microbiology, geomicrobiology, chemistry, and then on through planetary sciences, cosmology, and so it was that whole sweep of the disciplines that make up astrobiology. However, I will say this, that one of the very strong impressions that I came away with was that since kind of the beginning of time, I would imagine, and we certainly know from the beginning of recorded written history with the Greeks and Romans, that the question of whether or not there were additional planets out there and whether or not there was life on them is something that has been very heavily, very broadly discussed. And when you think about it, most religions and not just New Age ones are predicated on the presence of some kind of living beings up in the sky, be they gods, be they angels, be they jinns. In an Islamic tradition, there's the Chinese have the Jade Emperor. It's something that seems to be kind of both instinctive in people, and perhaps even more than that, just a desire. I mean, they hope that there is some kind of life out there, and it tends to be projected onto, you know, into these kinds of mystical and powerful and religious forces. What I find, remarkably fascinating is that what the science is doing is saying, well, yeah, there may, you know, there probably really is stuff out there, and who knows, maybe we'll find someday in the way, way future, even, you know, intelligent life. But putting that aside, we will almost certainly find microbial life and maybe more complex life, and that we are not alone in the universe. And that's, to some extent, the bottom line of what a lot of humanity has been looking for a long time.
Also, before we get into your book, let me ask you another question. With all the scientists that you spoke with, I had a guest on about 2 weeks ago who was making the case for, we already have confirmed that there was past microbial life on Mars. Done deal. Nothing more need be said about it other than to continue to research it. But it's absolutely fact, a fait accompli. But when he was pushed, he said NASA and the government won't do it and won't announce it because they are afraid of offending different religious groups that would really go bonkers if even past life on Mars or a planet were announced. So I personally have never found that kind of attitude to be there in talking to a lot of astrobiologists. But did you ever find that they would cover something up or not disclose it, even if it was past life, because of concern about religion?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, one never, you don't know what you don't know. But there was the 1995 announcement of the Mars meteorite ALH84001, where David McKay, a NASA scientist, and his team of NASA scientists from Johnson Space Center had a paper in Science, the journal Science, and had a huge press conference in Washington at NASA headquarters, where they announced that there were what they considered to be six biosignatures in this Mars meteorite, and that while they didn't 100% confirm the presence of the past presence of life, that they made a pretty persuasive case. It was interesting because they ultimately got clobbered, but not by NASA, but by their, you know, their colleagues. The scientists now, 15 years later, still hold that they were right, and say that they have found other microfossils and other signatures in Mars meteorites, but it's hard for them to get a platform now because this other news came out with such fanfare, and then a number of people poked holes in it, and some of those holes probably were unfair. I mean, in the sense that the initial science was sound, but once a consensus begins to form within the science community or begins to disintegrate, which is what happened here, very hard to put it back together again. But no, I have never sensed that NASA was holding things back. In fact, just the opposite, that they seem to be eager, perhaps sometimes even a little bit too eager to get information out.
So probably in all of your book tours, I mean, I would imagine that most of your interviews go along a similar kind of line. But I thought what might be interesting, because at the end of your book, you provide three options in your analysis that you believe could exist. I was thinking it might be good order and make sense to reference those three options up front and then tell us how your research fed into, nurtured, contradicted, supported those three options and how you came to those three options. So in a way, using your three options in your last chapter as an introduction to how you did your work on your book and how all of this came together for you and made sense to take you to those outcomes. Does that work for you?
That's a very fine idea. So
listeners, here we go. Option one, and I'll read all of the options, and then we'll turn it back over to Mark. We are alone in the universe, and Earth is the only planet, moon, asteroid, comet, or undiscovered other body anywhere with life. So that's the first option. Option number two, only Earth has complex life. And then his third option is life exists beyond Earth and in some instances has become complex and most likely includes what we would consider intelligence. So if we work backwards from these three, what led you to these outcomes?
Okay. Well, the first is a series of things. We know that all the makings, the elements and the compounds needed to make life exist throughout the universe. There's water, there are complex carbons, there's nitrogen, there's hydrogen, there's oxygen, and since those are the elements we suspect would be involved in any other form of life, the fact that they're all out there makes it to some extent logical that they would that they could someplace form. Then we have the presence, and this is all relatively new science, the presence of a really infinite number of exoplanets. There have been 500 and some planets outside of our solar system that have been positively identified. There are 1,200 or so that were identified as candidates by the NASA's Kepler mission. And now you have people like Jeff Marcy, one of the top planet hunters, and others saying, based on the information that they've collected so far and that the field has collected, that they can expect that there will be billions of exoplanets in just our Milky Way. And then you have billions, hundreds of billions of other galaxies. So you have a vastness of the universe that is filled with stars, and we now know that many of those stars are going to have planets, and we know that that all of the ingredients needed for life as we know it are out there in the universe. And then what we have is, to some extent, kind of a clincher, is that we're really moving closer and closer to that discovery of past life or conceivably present life on Mars, and or possibly a different moon in our solar system. In Mars in particular, we know NASA now, and again this is consensus within the field, knows that Mars back 4 billion years ago, 4.2 billion years ago, was a pretty warm and wet place. It was not lush like Earth became, but it had an atmosphere. It had a magnetic field that held that atmosphere in place, and as a result, there was not the kind of radiation coming in, the killing radiation that there is now on Mars. The temperatures were a lot more moderate, and there's a lot of evidence now that there was running water. We can see some of the gullies. We know that there are elements. I'm sorry, that there are minerals there that form only in the presence of water. But then, most interesting of all, 2 years or so ago, there was an announcement about a paper regarding methane on Mars. Methane is a carbon-based gas that on Earth, 90% of the methane here is produced through biology, through rotting things, animals, whatever. There had always been, or there had long been, an understanding that there was a trace amount of methane in the Martian atmosphere, but what Mike Mumma of NASA Goddard and his team found after 18 years of work was that the methane was being released at specific places, at specific times, and in large amounts. So the overall picture of Mars is having just a tiny trace amount of methane, kind of was misleading because it was being released and then being fairly quickly destroyed in the atmosphere. But we now, there is good reason to believe that, that he's accurate on this, and I think the community has generally accepted it. And so the question is, okay, how did that methane get there? It could be geological, and if that's the case, then a lot of scientists would say, hey, that's really cool, because we thought Mars was dead geologically. But if it's biological, and there are a lot of microbes that the methanogens that produce methane, they could be living, you know, deep below the surface of the, of Mars. They're protected from all of the now hazardous forces there, and so they potentially could be there, and they're releasing the methane, and then maybe when the ice on top melts, it, you know, it just shoots out. So you put all that together, and you have a picture of a universe that has a certain fertility to it that that makes it, it would seem, virtually impossible that there not be life somewhere else. Then there's also, of course, the logical issue of because the number of potential planets out there is vast, the number of stars is, I think, 20 to the 23rd, so you got a lot of zeros there, you got a lot of stars, and then you got a lot of planets going around them, you know, we will never be able to say definitively that there is no life. I mean, that is simply impossible to say. But putting that aside, we also have a logic that says there's a very good chance that there is.
Okay, here's your wisdom test for the night. I saw your one with the 26 zeros. Can you please pronounce that number?
No.
I can't either. I don't know what it would be.
Yeah, I believe it would be, you know, what people would just say is, you know, 1 or 10 or 20 to the 23rd.
No, that doesn't count. I guess we could just refer them to the U.S. deficit, right? Maybe,
yeah, you know, okay.
We could let Congress do that. You have a serious question from a serious listener. This is Marshall, who is in Dallas. And Marshall says, in your travels and meetings, did religious groups assume, this assumes that you talked to religious groups, assume that there were intelligent life in deep space? Did any person or group support the idea that space-based intelligent life developed via evolution? And here's his prejudice, of course. Were there any that were not absolute creationists? I guess he's assuming that religious groups are absolute creationists. I think that's an unfair assumption, Marshall, but I'll let Mark talk about that.
Okay. Well, just to backtrack for a sec, this goes to the numbers, the questions number two and three, or the possibilities number two or three about there being life in the universe. And, you know, if there is microbial life, we know from the one example that we've had that life evolves. For about 3 billion of the 3.8 billion years that there has been life on Earth, it was just microbial. So that's primarily what life has been, and then it begins to evolve and then becomes complex. And there really is no reason to think that that same process wouldn't happen on other planets. There are a lot of forces at work that could be very harmful to life. You know, you could have an asteroid hit. You can have a star that doesn't have sufficient burning power to let the life evolve and so on. But, you know, given again the vastness of the numbers here, it's hard to think that there wouldn't be some kind of evolution into more complex and potentially intelligent life. So then, to put it into a religious context, there are the Catholic Church has very much embraced the notion that that there may well be life beyond Earth, and they think that that would be something that would be entirely consistent with their views. For those who might be interested, there is a absolutely hilarious Stephen Colbert takeoff on that. It was actually based on a story that I did from Rome when there was an astrobiology conference there. He brought in one of the Vatican astronomers, a guy named Brother Guy Consolmagno, and did an absolutely hilarious interview where he said, what are you doing here? Don't you understand that if you find life elsewhere, you're taking God and Christ in particular out of the whole human story? And there is that feeling out there. There is the traditional religion and hierarchies tend to say, well, you know, this is something that's utterly consistent with our religious worldview, be it Catholic or Jewish or Protestant or whatever. But there also are a lot of people who when you kind of push a little bit further, the idea that human beings would be that much further away from the center of what God's creation might be, if there would be potentially other intelligent beings or even just other beings, it raises a lot of kind of peculiar questions like, all right, well, is our human beings, is man really what the universe is all about, which is kind of at the heart of a lot of religion? Is it possible that there were Christs that came down not just to Earth but to other planets as well? And if not, then why not? I mean, if they were fallen creatures, then wouldn't they need to be redeemed as well? It seems a little bit like a supposition on a supposition on a supposition, but it's a theology that that in fact some people are talking about and thinking about. And then there were some people who would be considered fundamentalists who I did speak to, and they there's a guy in particular named Gary Bates in an organization in Georgia, I think it's Creation Ministries International, and his sense is that if there was intelligent life or quasi-intelligent life on other planets, that would be the end of Christianity for some of the reasons that I just was describing. He doesn't think that that'll ever happen, that there will ever be that discovery, but he said if there was, it would be the end of Christianity as he understood it. So
I don't think he understands it very well. But.
Maybe
I don't know.
because there are others who would say, this would just show a kind of divine grandness that's even grander. That there could be life on many other planets as well. But for those who are very literal or very earth-focused in their religious beliefs, the possibility of life elsewhere does pose that kind of problem.
You have a caller on hold, but I'll repeat the story I was told by a very famous scientist at NASA, from NASA in Johnson, years ago at a conference in Albuquerque. It was at the time the Terry Schiavo debate on keeping someone on, tubes and life support alive.
Mm-hmm.
And he was telling me over booze and cheese and fruit that they get lots of hate mail from the very religious people, which they respect because they're citizens and taxpayers like everyone else. And they really oppose much of the space program because when they go out into deep space, they don't find God, so they believe this is an effort to disprove the existence of God and all of what that means, because God isn't showing up in their deep space probes or however they wanted to do that. And they have to contend with a lot of mail like that, which says the space program should be shut down because man can't be searching for God that way. So
Interesting. I had not come across that per se, but I do know that some scientists kind of scratched their head about what NASA ended up saying and doing regarding the Viking mission back in the 70s.
Uh-huh.
Because the original finding of one of the four main experiments was that there was life, that they had a response from the labeled release experiment that was absolutely consistent with the definition that they had earlier created for what would be life. There were then other tests done that put that into question, but since that time, not the labeled release experiment, but rather the others have been proven to be limited, and so that they could not have found the organic material or other things that they were looking for, you know, even if they were there. So we were left with a situation where the experiment that to some extent has the greatest credibility from Viking is the one that's positive. And, you know, a lot of people kind of scratch their head and say, well, why don't we, you know, why are we then not saying that there is life on Mars? There are some decent responses to that, but that issue does sometimes come up.
Let's see who your caller is. Hopefully they've stayed with us. And are you still with us, caller, please?
Yeah, this is Marshall.
Oh, hi, Marshall. Thanks for hanging on.
Yeah, well, I sent you this earlier, but I'll read it, and then we'll kind of stir it a little bit for fun.
Well, we already answered it, so did you hear our answer?
I've been listening, but
okay.
It's got a little bit of a twist that I'm really looking for, and that is, did any person or group support the idea that space intelligent life developed via evolution? Is there any of them that do not absolutely state creationism? And I think that is probably the biggest theological issue.
I think that it would be accurate to say that some of the people who have some of the greatest skepticism about what NASA is doing and the effort to find life elsewhere would be people who do believe in a literal interpretation of the Bible. I think you're right about that. There are, of course, a lot of other people who think that the money should be spent elsewhere, but that's an entirely different issue. Yes, there is that component. I don't think that group or that my that view of things plays much of a role in what NASA does or doesn't do, because what I've found after, you know, the 2-3 years of reporting about it was that in effect that the search for life beyond Earth has really been hardwired into virtually everything that NASA does in space and a lot of other kind of projects for looking for extreme life on Earth, looking for analogs for other planets and whether, you know, here on Earth, and then seeing whether or not there could be life there. And it's not just here in the U.S. It's around the world that there is this, as I said, this kind of stealth Apollo program going on through a lot of disciplines to look at whether or not there, you know, or not so much whether or not there's life out there, but rather to identify what is expected to be life out there.
Mm-hmm. Now to stir the pot just a touch, does anybody really sit down and discuss Fermi's paradox, the basic statement of life is... intelligent life is so abundant in space, why haven't they visited? Does anybody really address that?
Well, it's definitely something that you hear, and it raises a number of interesting questions. As I thought about it, I kind of, you know, took it apart in several different ways. The first was when Fermi posited that, it was in the early 1950s, and when you think about all that we have learned since then about the nature of the universe and the possibilities of life beyond Earth, of, you know, the existence of exoplanets, the whole world of extremophiles here on Earth, he didn't know any of that. So he was speaking without that kind of scientific context. And then the other side of it is, you know, why hasn't someone contacted us? And there are a lot of ways you could approach that. The first is, well, maybe they did, but, you know, maybe that was during the time when there was just microbes here. Time in a universe that we understand that began with the Big Bang 14 billion years ago, you know, there could have been intelligent cultures, let's say 6 billion years ago, and they came here or somewhere else, and they found nothing. And the time period in which there has been an ability on Earth to understand and in any way communicate with what might be intelligent life is you know, infinitesimal. It's just, you know, like 100 years, 200 years. So those are the thoughts that would come to my mind. We don't entirely know that nobody has ever come here. There's no way of really knowing that. It can't be scientifically proven one way or the other. And that, too, the amount of time involved here makes it so the paradox almost has, to me, no meaning. You know, that we don't know, that we can't determine that happened, that we have no way of knowing it right now, just based, placed against the vastness of space and the vastness of the time in space, seems insignificant. So those are the thoughts that come to my mind.
Thank you very much. Have fun.
Thank you, okay. Marshall. Mark, we're a little behind the eight ball. Let's take our first break, okay?
Okay.
And we'll be back, listeners, in 3 minutes. We're talking to Mark Kaufman. The book, which, by the way, is on the One Giant Leap Foundation Amazon Partners website. Remember, if you do buy it there, Amazon contributes nicely to the space show, which is always helpful. First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Tuesday Evening Space Show. Our guest, Mark Kaufman, his book, First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. And he is over at the Washington Post as science editor. By the way, the book has fabulous photographs in it that help make many of the points that he brings up in the book. You know, making it an even better book than it is already with straight text. Going back to the three options that you have concluded with, I know you wanted to pick up and say some more.
Sure. There's a pretty well-known book called Rare Earth by a number of researchers, scientists up at the University of Washington in Seattle. And in it, they make the argument that there is every reason to believe that that there is microbial life scattered throughout the universe. That the logic of that is very sound. Their view, though, is that because so many things have to go right in order for the microbes to have the time and the atmosphere and the absence of extinction kind of events, that it takes so long for that process to result in evolution, that there is very, from their point of view, good reason to believe that there are few, if any, advanced, intelligent, technologically advanced societies. Or peoples. And what I concluded, again, speaking to a lot of scientists and thinking about it myself, but because I'm not a scientist, primarily relying on their views, was that there's an aspect to that argument that feels a little bit like the argument going back to, you know, pre-Copernicus that the sun went around the earth, that we're the center, that we're the special ones, you know, that earth is unique in so many ways. And God knows earth is unique in many ways. However, there really isn't, as far as I can tell, reason to think that what happened here couldn't happen on other exoplanets, and that there is no reason to think that specialness that people tend to afford to Earth is accurate for precisely those reasons. I mean, Earth has had extinction events and was, at the time that Mars was warmer and wetter, that's when we were getting clobbered by a planet that later became our moon. And goodness knows that was not a time when there was any life here. There was a time of snowball Earth when most everything died because it was so cold, and we certainly know about the extinction of the dinosaurs. So extinction events are the norm on Earth and would be the norm elsewhere. But why argue that other planets couldn't have the same ability to make it through as happened on Earth? And the other side of that argument involves the very, very real and very quickly advancing science of extremophiles, which are microbial life, although now it's also to some extent more complex life, that we have found can live on Earth in environments that 10 years ago, 5 years ago, people never imagined as being possible. These would be starting out with the black smokers at the bottom, hydrothermal vents at the bottom, generally of the Pacific, 700-degree elements are coming out of there, and yet there is microbial life that exists not right in the middle of it, but, you know, fairly close to it at temperatures that everyone thought were impossible. We now know that there's microbial life 2 miles, let's say, below the surface of Antarctica and all the way down in the ice, that the microbes exist in kind of these little rivulets of water that surround an actual ice crystal in a glacier. Recently, there's been discussion about Mono Lake in California, and which is very heavily has a lot of arsenic in it, and we know there are microbes, there's bears. There's a question as to whether or not there's a shadow biosphere there that we could go into if you'd like. But then, to me, most interesting is the deep subsurface where we now know that probably, you know, that more than half of the biomass of the living material on Earth is below ground. And by that I mean not only below, you know, where you and I are seated, but also below the ocean bed. So we're not in, so everything that's in the ocean would be considered the same thing as the trees and the animals here. And yet the biomass below that is greater than what there is above. So there is this whole world of microbes and of bacteria and whatever, and the logic here says, well, if life is that tenacious, if life can adapt that successfully, why wouldn't it be, say, adapting like that in Mars or, you know, 16 zillion other planets which at some point had a warm and wet period, and then perhaps things went south, and then the microbes figured out a way to adapt, and maybe it may well have been to go underground. I mean, that's what we now have proof of that here, that it's possible.
Here's an email question from Karen, who is in Denver, Colorado, and she said, in all of your travels and discussions with the scientists and the experts, what was the most reasonable near-in timeline that you came away with where some sort of serious life might be discovered on another planet?
An awful lot of that depends on NASA funding or the European Space Administration, but organizations such as SETI, people such as Sarah Seeger, who is, you know, one of the shining lights here, and others, I think that what they would say is 20, 25 years is the kind of time frame. Of course, it could be sooner. We have a mission going to Mars. It's supposed to lift off in October, November of this year. It would be landing on Mars in August of 2012. By far the most sophisticated piece of equipment that ever has landed on Mars. Its capabilities are directed toward finding organic material and habitats where there might be life, but it also has some ability to actually detect that there is life or that there once was life. So it's conceivable that it could be as early as the next couple of years if that Martian mission is successful in that regard. And one of the points that scientists often make, and this is more the physicists and astrophysicists and cosmologists, which I think is important for people to keep in mind, and certainly was one of my driving forces. If there is found, just the tiniest remnant of microbial life on Mars, let's say, or Enceladus or Titan or Europa, if it clearly did not come from the same tree of life, as it were, that we have here on Earth, then we have in one solar system, which is not, we now know, unusual by any means. There are zillions of solar systems like ours. If there were two different origins of life in one solar system, then the probability that there is life a lot of other places, in fact, it's a commonplace, goes up astronomically. Because one genesis is, an anomaly that is hard to explain, but it could just be an anomaly. But once you have two, then it becomes clear that that whole logic of how life begins on Earth and how it could begin on other planets is probably accurate.
You know, you only need to find one white elephant to prove that all elephants are not gray.
That's right.
That's kind of the old saying that you're talking about. Trent in Australia has sent in a note that says, could you please ask your guest to discuss how he thinks life will be discovered on the exoplanets? How do you think it'll show up? What will be the process to discover it?
Thank you for the question. In the near term, and by that I mean, 15, 20 years, the way that it would be done would be through analyzing the atmospheres of those exoplanets. And by that I mean, using spectrometers, determining what elements are there. And this is the kind of work that Sarah Seeger in particular has pioneered, and others have followed, that if the exoplanet has an abundance of oxygen in its atmosphere, or ozone in particular, then that would be an almost 100% sure sign that there was biology going on. Oxygen and ozone are elements and compounds that that bond with other things very quickly and would not show up as being just themselves unless there was a constant supply, as there is on Earth. And as far as we know, the only thing that produces a constant supply of oxygen, and then which then morphs into ozone, is biology. It's life. So that's what they would be looking for. They might also be looking for methane in atmospheres on some level. That's a little bit more complicated, but since it would be hard to determine if it was geological or biological, but oxygen, ozone is what they're really looking for. It's one of the constraints of this whole process that back in the about 10 years ago, 8 years ago, there were two missions that were commissioned by NASA to go out and try to make that kind of determination. They were called the Terrestrial Planet Finders, and they're looking for rocky planets where there are atmospheres that can be analyzed. There was a lot of dispute within the communities, the space community, as to how to go about doing it. The project became very expensive, and the upshot is that there is no terrestrial planet finder program going forward. So that's something that's going to take some time to recoup from and to find some other ways of doing that kind of analysis, but. The way I think about it is, if from telescopes here on Earth, Mike Mumma and others at NASA can determine that there's methane being released at particular places at particular times on Mars, then as the telescopes get more and more, larger and more precise, probably we could, someday imagine being able to do the same thing with some exoplanets.
Do you think, earlier you said that it, in a way it sort of depends on budgets with NASA and ESA. I certainly don't know as much about the ESA budget as I do NASA's, but you've got James Webb Telescope consuming almost all of its departmental budget with its cost overruns. And Mars Science Lab, which you talked about earlier, and its rover, Curiosity, is in deep doo-doo trouble with cost overruns, and they also have found out that the drill is likely to contaminate any samples that they drill with and that it touches. And NASA says they probably will have a fix using software to screen out contaminants. But if all of this means they miss their launch window, they're looking at in 2 more years before they can launch, and $570 billion in the cost of the delay, which in this day and age of budgets, who knows if it would even survive a 2-year delay if that happened. And then if they rush to get it off, in the window this November, you know, that to the degree that they rush, it increases the probability that they got a boo-boo in their calculations or something.
Yeah.
So it's really kind of disconcerting, because I think you're right that so much of this search is depending on what NASA, and to a smaller degree, because the ESA budget I know is just a fraction of what NASA's is, are able to do.
Just to tweak something, I think you had said that the cost overrun would be $560 billion. I think that's million.
Million, I'm sorry, yeah. Half a billion dollars, yeah.
People here in Washington and at NASA headquarters are pretty sanguine. They think that it will in fact launch this year. They could be wrong, but they remain confident that they're going to be able to send it up and that it will be in good shape, although you're absolutely right that they're going to still be figuring out some of the software as the thing flies to Mars, which is kind of disconcerting when you think about it. But something that we haven't really talked about, and which is so key to all this, is precisely the commercial space industry. The cost of launch now is just going way, way up, and that's one of the major constraints on NASA. But if Blue Horizon and SpaceX and others are able to put together programs where they can get satellites and spacecraft into orbit or beyond for a quarter of the cost, for you know a third of the cost, or even a half of the cost, that's going to just change everything. I've done a number of stories about SpaceX and met the people there, and watched like many people did as its first capsule went around the globe and landed precisely where it was supposed to, and I came away very impressed that there is a developing model there for a commercial space industry that could really change everything fairly quickly, and I think probably an awful lot of us have our fingers crossed that that'll actually happen.
I don't know, but the commercial space industry is not really engaged in the search for life. I mean, you know, this is another, you know, big problem and issue. I don't even know if there's a commercial potential in the search for life, because if you found past life on Mars or something, how do you market it to make money? I mean,
here's the way in which it would play in, and actually already is getting ready to. There are these little things called CubeSats, little small satellites they have a lot of different capabilities. One I know is designed to just look at a particular star kind of indefinitely to see whether or not there are transiting planets going in front of it. And these CubeSats will be launched. They're planned to be launched on the Falcon 9, the first one that goes up to the ISS. So the commercial space industry, you're right, will not necessarily be doing the science, but they can get equipment up into space potentially much more cheaply, and very inventive people are already thinking about that and figuring out ways to piggyback up there, and NASA is very supportive of that, and they already, some of that's already on the docket.
Yeah, I've talked to many of the scientists, and they are very concerned at how much of their budgets are being eaten up by the rising launch cost prices in the traditional aerospace launchers. And when they put in their grant request or funding request, they are required to use the maximum price estimated for the duration of whatever time period their grant covers. So if ULA is saying an Atlas launch in 2015 is going to be $185 million or $220 million, they have to budget for that, even if the cost is not that high. So this is killing their research and academic budgets and all of what you just talked about. So if they had an option with SpaceX, for example, and other commercials to do this for a significantly lower cost, it gives them a lot more bang for their buck and really excites them and gives them a lot more possibilities. You're 100%
absolutely
right.
Absolutely. And then you have organizations like the Bigelow folks who are talking about a space lab, or just some people call it a hotel. I know they don't like that, but a space habitat that they would put into orbit, and they would then work out ways to bring people up, and it would be tourism to some extent to begin with, but it's all the process of learning how to in a cost effective way to transport people off of the planet and up into space. And once they're up there, they could do all kinds of stuff. There are plans afoot. I know that there's a company in already working, I believe, with Boeing, a small company, to figure out how they could mine the moon for water. We now know that there's quite a bit of water, particularly in the southern polar area. And when you're up in space, in a Bigelow habitat or whatever else, two of the things you're going to need are H2O, and you're going to need oxygen, and you need hydrogen also as a fuel. So they would be mining the water that then would be something of great value to whatever economy would be there in space. Now, again, this kind of sounds like science fiction and isn't really what my book is about, other than to say that an awful lot of science comes from, kind of on the back of other ventures, and if the commercial industry can flourish and does flourish, then I think the scientific implications of that are very positive.
You have a question by email, and again, listeners, we're pushing everybody to use a toll-free line on this show, 1-866-687-7223. So Jerry is in upstate New York, and here's his question for you. What do you think the chances are for the NASA Terrestrial Planet Finder? What are the chances for the NASA Terrestrial Planet Finder having of being funded? I think there's a word missing there. Having of being funded, given the problems with the James Webb Space Telescope and the possibility that it will be canceled.
The Terrestrial Planet Finders, they've already been defunded. So
they're old missions now.
Right. They are no longer on the board. That's something that whole exoplanet community has kind of been mourning about. Although they also have now the Kepler mission that's up there and is, finding these astounding, multi-planet solar systems and vast numbers of planets and planets of different types that they never imagined and in proportions that they never imagined. So, on the one hand, the exoplanet community is, this is the best of all times. They have telescopes on the ground that are telling them great things, and they have telescopes in the sky for the first time that are telling them great things. The TPF, though, is a heartbreak for them because it just ain't going to happen. And they know that, and it's they're going to have to work around it and find other ways. The James Webb, it's hard to imagine that they won't somehow find the money to put it together and get it up. And it will cost a vast sum of money, and as you pointed out, that's eating away a lot of other budgets, and people are not happy about that. But I think that it would be probably fair to say, if you step back and think about it, that over the last 15 years, the most successful mission of that NASA has done is Hubble. And so what they're doing is just trying to, you know, repeat that in a way to order to move on to a more sophisticated version of Hubble. And it is putting all your money or a lot of your money into one basket there. But given the history of Hubble, there's a certain logic to it.
Let's turn back to your book. Of the three scenarios that I read a few minutes ago, well, more than a few minutes ago, when we started the show, which one is the one that you subscribe to, or do you subscribe to one of the three options?
Well, I do, and this is again based on, you know, long conversations with many scientists and you know, cosmologists and people who think a lot about this stuff. It seems highly implausible that there wouldn't be, in the absolute vastness of space and the vastness of time, that there isn't now or there wasn't in the past some kind of evolved life. Evolved life, you know, I don't know what that means. It could be a dolphin. You know, it could be something that isn't, that doesn't look like a human being. But it could have intelligence and potentially could even have technological capabilities. It's interesting that I was at SETI recently, and you know, their definition of intelligence involves technological ability. So you know, what they're looking for is a very small, in a sense, just a small slice of it. But it appears to me, given the logic of evolution, given the logic of how and why extraterrestrial life seems like it would be, you know, virtually impossible to not be there, put the two together, and I think that you have, again, in this vast canvas that we're working with, it seems impossible that there wouldn't be some kind of evolved life.
Except, you know, it's not there, to the best of our knowledge. I guess the question would be, how much more sophisticated or smart do you believe we have to be able to confirm evolved life? I mean,
well,
we're pretty smart now.
That definitely is a tough one. And,
yeah.
I went into my project here not being kind of a skeptic of SETI. I mean, it seemed, you know, like there's a certain needle in a haystack quality to it. You know, trying to hear some unnatural message being sent, or now also with the optical SETI, you know, some unnatural pulsing of a laser, and it still is to me something of a needle in a haystack project. But I realize that that's, you know, that's to some extent what we got right now, and in terms of trying to make any kind of or come to any conclusions about intelligent life. Is it out there? We won't know that for a long, long time. Here's a for instance. In speaking to Jill Tarter at SETI, you know, she's often asked, well, you know, why haven't there been any messages so far? You've been doing this for 50 years. And she likens the number of star systems that they have examined, and they've examined them in a way that may not even be the right way, but putting that aside for a second, the total number, she said, would be comparable to a cup of water taken out of the entirety of the ocean. So, you know, she says, hey, we've hardly even started. I mean, we're like beyond... way beyond, or way before starting, almost. So, in just kind of an answer to your general question of like, why haven't we made contact, or why don't we know that there's life out there? It's so the distances are so great, the time element is so deep, the ways in which people, beings might communicate are so different. Just very hard to say that they're not there just because we haven't we don't have clear evidence that they are.
You know, it doesn't really relate to our space discussion, but since you're a science writer at the Post, maybe you saw the story or not. But I have also often contended that the answers to a lot of these issues, as well as, say, cures to illness and diseases, are already here and in front of us. We just don't know how to see it or find it, especially since I guess matter really can't be destroyed. You can only change the form of it, right? So here a couple of weeks ago, you know, I'm reading these articles about this young high school kid in Canada who got an internship in a bio lab after being turned down by everybody, and decides to combine two existing drugs together, and voila, has a probable cure for cystic fibrosis. You know, and the drugs already exist. And then there's a young girl who gets an internship, and I think she's in a college someplace in Australia, and she takes an existing well-known math formula for something to do in astrophysics, and I don't remember the details, and she applies it differently, and she can now account for the missing matter in the universe. And her adaptation of this formula, which has been around for a long time, is now circulating among scientists for replication, as is the Canadian kid's research is now, you know, going into real trial labs to confirm what this kid, who had been turned down elsewhere, discovered. So again, it's not that they found something that never existed before. They saw something differently than everybody else. And
yeah, it's
amazing, isn't it?
A most interesting point, and that's kind of a for me a nice kind of segue into one of the more controversial, but to me also one of the more intriguing developments related to astrobiology in the last half a year or so. You may recall that there was a lot of reporting about a team sponsored partially by NASA, but also by the there's some people from the U.S. Geological Survey, and then Paul Davies from Arizona State. And what they were looking for was a shadow biosphere. You know, their hypothesis is if life began once on Earth, and we know that it did, why would we assume that it didn't evolve other times? And maybe some of those the progeny of that are still around. It's just that we don't look for them, and we don't look for them because we're always looking for things to be a particular, you know, to have a particular DNA sequence and to have particular kinds of elements in the molecules and so on. And so, to some extent, based on the inspiration from Paul Davies and also a kind of an astrobiological philosopher named Carol Cleland at the University of Colorado out in Boulder, the woman Felisa Wolf-Simon went out to Mono Lake and started working with the microbial life there that has adapted to so much arsenic. And she, doing just kind of basic bench work, pushed it further and further until she got to a situation where she contends, and she has she had a lot of sophisticated people analyzing this before the paper came out in Science. She contends that the phosphorus in the DNA and also in the, I think, the cell membrane and some of the other proteins of this microbe, the phosphorus had been replaced by arsenic. And if that is the case, then that actually would be potentially a different kind of life, different than anything else that there is. It would have and could have had a different ancestor. Now, that particular finding got jumped on in the blogosphere and by a lot of scientists, and it is far from being confirmed. But I spoke with Felisa a couple weeks ago, met with her, and despite all of the criticism, she now is putting together a larger and larger team of people to look at this and to see almost precisely what you were saying, you know, looking for things that are right potentially there in front of us, and that we don't look for because we've never been, because the idea of it has never really come up. But maybe it's there, and maybe it's, if not simple, you know, it's still gettable.
I want to follow up on this, and it also brings up something about past life on Mars with what Dr. Huber did and the reaction to his work in the Journal of Cosmology. But you have a caller on hold, and I want to take the caller first. So, hello, caller. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Okay.
And you are?
This is John Atlanta.
Oh, hi. I didn't recognize your voice.
Yeah. I've listened to this, this discussion. It kind of hit me as this amazing amount of just doubt that life would be out there. It seems to me that, I guess, man, I always take this as almost most likely in a vast universe that there would be life out there.
Well, I don't think we're talking either. Yeah. Mark or I have doubt. I mean, I totally believe we're surrounded by life. I mean, I believe that since I was a little kid. That's how I got into wanting space. I used to look with my Cub Scout telescope for flying saucers all the time. No, I'm not kidding you. I wanted ET contact more than I wanted anything, even a girlfriend as I was growing up. You know, only my dogs had a higher priority. But and I'm not hearing Mark having any doubt, you know, given the vastness of the universe and our increasing ability to detect things. I think it's inevitable. Am I right, Mark? Am I putting words in your mouth?
No. I agree with you. And I think what's changed and what the book is tries to lay out is that what you described as the belief that there was life out there. Is being gradually either replaced by or supplemented by hard science that says, well, yeah, it is out there, and now it still hasn't been found, but there's so much more science, good hard science, cutting edge science, some of the best science that's being done on Earth is in this field, and it is leading us closer and closer, or clearly to that conclusion. So it's taking some of the question of life beyond Earth out of the world of I believe it to, you know, it's scientifically sound that it is there, and then hopefully that it's actually found.
Yeah, I mean, John, I think the reptilians are already here. I think they've taken over our entire government. So, you know, I can't prove it any more than I can prove this or that one as a walk-in. Here comes my New Age background. But your thoughts, John, are we ever going to detect some kind of other life out there, or do you think it's not going to be there?
Well, I think it'll be there. Detection, I guess the question is where it is. If it's inside the solar system, in terms of, like you say, microbial life, or maybe on Mars, or maybe Europa, or something like that, and I think that's probably within the range, like you say, the number of years it would take to get probes out there that could determine it. If it's interstellar, it becomes much more difficult to actually prove it if we're talking about just microbes and stuff. I mean, like you say, the presence of oxygen, it's already been discussed, and things of that sort, and ozone. The other issue, of course, is intelligent life, the sense of technological life, and how frequently that would occur, and the chances of us actually encountering that, or, you know, that's a whole different area, you know. I mean, because we think about how long life has been on this planet, and what the short span that we've even had the technologies we have now, you know. You know, but the other aspect that's always been pointed out is that certainly a lot of these civilizations would theoretically, if they exist, would be before us. And so once they reach this level, you know, they should be several of them that are you know, it would be millions and millions and tens of millions of years beyond us, you know.
Or they destroy themselves, like, you know.
Or they destroy them. Well, there's that doctor, is it Gott, I believe, his theory that there's a short envelope.
Right, the entropic theory.
Entropic theory, yeah. I guess that's a different viewpoint on it, that life has a short, you know, window of opportunity to basically get off the home planet and establish itself elsewhere, or else it loses its opportunity or something like
right,
that.
Right, and then I've heard others talk about four different levels of planets based kind of on the energy that they would have, and the odds of going from one level to the other are increasingly diminished, because the more energy you're able to harness, the more likely you're going to destroy yourself, you know, through war or weapons or whatever. And so to get to the level of planets that could, of civilizations that could harness the amount of energy for interstellar travel, based on what we know, which may turn out to be irrelevant, would be few and far between, because most would never survive the evolution to get there. So that's another theory that I've had expressed on the space show. Of course, it's all, you know, equivalent to the PowerPoint rocket, because there's no way to validate any of this stuff. But
all conjecture.
Yeah.
But I guess I could jump in, and what attracted me so much to astrobiology now is that while there certainly does remain a lot of conjecture, there also is a lot of scientific breakthroughs. I mean, you know, they really do now know that there are all these exoplanets. They didn't know that 15 years ago. They do know, you know, they know that life is tenacious in a way that was unimaginable, and those are the things that particularly excite me, because they're, you know, they're really grounded in the best of science, and they since I think all of us really want this to be true, you know, we want there to be life out there, we want there to be more than just Earth as being biological, you know, that's what's so attractive about it, that we're using the best tools we have to answer perhaps the biggest question we have.
You know, absolutely. And, of course, also, we know there's methane on Mars and elsewhere. We know there's water out there. So we have so much more knowledge about the building blocks of life and where they are, or at least life as we know it. I think it's inevitable, and I'm just waiting for the establishment of silicon life. I haven't heard anyone other than a good author talk about that one, but maybe that'll show up out there too.
Well, the other issue is brought up is the CD and all that, and that presumes, of course, that the alien civilization or has advanced the level that has the technology to send signals and then makes a decision to send the signals.
Correct, and wants contact with us. Maybe they don't want first contact.
Well, I mean, maybe if they agree with Professor Hawking's viewpoints, they don't want to attract the wrong kind of attention, perhaps.
Right, or yeah, this is interesting stuff too, because there is now this very active debate in the world of SETI as to whether or not we should move beyond listening to large-scale messaging, the MEDI instead of SETI, messaging of extraterrestrial intelligence, and you know, really start sending out a lot of very powerful signals, much more than what we do now through, you know, all of the radio and television stuff that is in our atmosphere, and as a way to try to jumpstart that process of making communication. But then you do indeed have the Stephen Hawkings and many others who say, don't do that, don't let them know we're here, because then they'll come and things probably won't be very good.
What if you send the signals and get them to come from North Korea and Iran and a couple of countries like that? Will that help? Well, that matters. Let them
get the signals from there, and
yeah. So they'll if they're going to do any harm, they do it on our behalf, you know, as a as kind of a clone or a surrogate or something. I don't know. I'm just kidding. But
No, I think that they would, you know, we're just one planet at that point.
Probably. John, what else do you have to share with us?
Well, a thing also gets into the question on that issue is kind of like, what is the ultimate trajectory of technological progress? What do the laws of physics allow? I mean, unless there is some kind of extreme paradigm shift that would allow something like the kind of science fiction, you know, faster and light space drives and things like that, which doesn't seem to be likely at the present time, then if you're left with, you know, what we think of as physics now as being more or less correct, and, you know, then it's going to be very difficult in terms of energy for any extraterrestrial civilization to reach us.
Okay, John, I'm going to blow you away with a chapter that Mark has in this book, because you haven't read the book yet. This chapter is Life and the Laws of Physics, and he set out a plausible scenario, and Mark, you can jump in and correct me and add to it, where different regions have different laws of physics that they're operating under. So maybe what we know here on Earth, or what we're working with, is not the same as someplace else in our solar system. And he has a very plausible scenario for that in the book. You want to say some more about that? Because that's
a great chapter,
Mark.
This is some of the most kind of mind-bending stuff that I came across. And it's not that it's hidden at all. I mean, there's a lot of discussion in the field about it. When you think about the way that the universe works, it involves a precision in terms of what's frequently called the fine tuning that is required, or else there could be no stars, there could be no planets, there could be nothing. And there are any number of parameters there. I mean, we're talking about things like the ratio in weight of a proton to a neutron. The neutron is, I think, 0.0001 heavier than a proton. And if that wasn't the case, then for a variety of reasons that I have to admit I don't fully understand, that there could basically be no chemistry. Similarly, the relationship between mass and gravity has to be very close to what it is, or else the way that the universe formed could not exist or could not happen. One of the most famous examples of this, and this goes back a number of decades now, was the formation of carbon, which is obviously essential to life as we know it. And carbon is formed as stars go supernova and explode, as an element, it requires the presence of another element, beryllium, to be vibrating at a certain frequency, or else the carbon won't be formed in the way that it has to be formed. And there are any number of these kinds of fine-tuning aspects, and, you know, folks like Martin Rees, who's the Astronomer Royal of the UK, has written a lot about this, and as have other cosmologists and theoretical physicists. And all of it raises, to me, some absolutely stunning questions, which is, well, okay, you have a really, really finely tuned universe. How could that be? It could be one, just pure coincidence again, that it just happened to turn out that way, and chances of that seem fairly limited, but, you know, okay. Two, there's a creator, which is scientifically not something that could be proven one way or the other. But then three, there's the whole world of the multiverse that is now very actively described or discussed in the world of cosmology. And so what they say is that There are, you know, an infinite number of universes. We just happen to live in the one universe where the laws of physics work in a way that that allow stars to be formed and ultimately the proper elements to be formed. As kind of a variation on that, a very kind of imaginative astrophysicist named Lee Smolin up in Canada came up with the idea that there is kind of a natural selection of physics, that there would be a physics at the beginning of the life of a universe, but if it didn't form some of the things that that were possibly formed, then another more effective kind of natural selection of kinds of physics would take over. This again is not something that can be proven by science, just like, you know, creation can't be proven, and at this point the idea of a multiverse can't be proven either. But just in terms of mind-bending thoughts, this is where scientists are really putting a lot of effort and are trying to understand something that seems virtually incomprehensible, yet fascinating.
Yeah. Well, yeah, some of that sounds very much like the anthropic principle approach. Some of the things say, not so much the Smolin, but, you know, the idea that basically we being intelligent life that has a certain characteristic only exists in those element of a multiverse in which that could occur. The ones which would be too chaotic or unsuitable for that, they wouldn't be intelligent life to notice what was happening.
You're right. Although I think the anthropic principle does not necessarily involve a multiverse, or didn't initially. It was more a description of how we are the universe that we are because there are human beings here who can understand, you know, look out and make those kinds of determinations. But some people would say, well, yeah, that's a tautology. It's obviously true. But I believe that the science has gone, or the thinking about this has gone past the anthropic to a world of multiverses that would have all different kinds of you know, bubbles and natural selection and form. But what they're all reaching for is something that can be in some way measured and proven to be right or wrong. The anthropic principle, I think, is also something that can't really be proven one way or the other. It's kind of a theory that's thrown out there, and there's a lot of debate about it. But it is in that same sense beyond science.
Yeah. Okay. Article of faith. I think that if you do have a multiverse, that I'm just saying that something like that would prevail. That obviously the universes that would be unsuitable for the formation of life, like say carbon or whatever, like you were discussing, wouldn't have carbon-based life in it to notice that it existed.
Absolutely, yes.
So there'd be a whole bunch of essentially dead universes, or, you know, they'd be kind of like, well, they exist, but they're lifeless, you know.
Yeah, and potentially that could be, you know, all of the universes but ours, although we then get back to that same notion of, you know, what makes us special. You know, instead of just our planet, you know, we would then make it into our universe as being the only one that would have life. But just kind of as a final thought about this, one of the things that Lee Smolin also posits, and this is, you know, just kind of wild to think about, that the Big Bang is always described as what happens when you have a singularity. You have this incredible mass, kind of forced together into a singular entity, and then it explodes. Well, a black hole basically forms that same thing. It sucks in all this mass, and then it forms a singularity. So what Smolin says is, well, you know, why don't we posit that on the other side of every major black hole is a Big Bang?
Yeah, that's an interesting concept,
isn't it? I mean, it's, again, nothing that we're going to be able to prove in our lifetimes, but there's a certain logic to it, and it's kind of a wonderful thing to think about.
Yeah, that is a very interesting idea, and the fact of the matter is, I think with the inflation type phenomena, once it doesn't take much of a seed to get going to actually create a universe, because it generates energy out of, you know, counterbalancing potential energy that's negative with the mass and energy that's being created is positive. It sums to zero pretty much. So, see, yeah, that's the whole thing. Some kind of fluctuation has to get this started, and that's what we can't explain.
Right. And then the other thing that we can't explain, and this is part of astrobiology as well, is how that actual, you know, that first life did begin, you know, that you had inanimate elements, and then somehow they came together and became something that could replicate and then could, you know, metabolize and reproduce and do all that stuff. And it's interesting because of all the people, of all the scientists that I spoke to, you know, across all the disciplines, the ones who have the most doubt about there being life elsewhere are the ones involved in synthetic biology, trying to create biology, you know, new life forms in labs. And they say it's just so hard. And they're even starting far along because they go to a supply store and they buy a little bit of DNA or RNA. And even with that, they can't make something that can self-replicate. So it's interesting that the two things that we really don't understand at all are, you know, how that Big Bang occurred, and then how inanimate life or inanimate elements came together and became something living.
John, I want to move on. Anything else?
That'll be it.
Hey, have you done your homework on VLF transmission from space to submarines for tomorrow night?
I think I have some ideas on.
All right, I'm looking for your call in sometime during the program tomorrow night.
Okay. Thank you, John.
Thank you. We're past the showtime. Can you stay for one more question?
Sure.
Okay, so this is from Ellen, and Ellen's in Las Vegas, and Ellen says, "Seems like ages ago when you were talking about Mono Lake." And what happened when the scientist produced her arsenic theory from the blogosphere. I can't believe the phone is ringing again. We'll never get off the phone, and I'll never eat dinner, and I'll never get to see the end of the Giants game. So, here's her. Ellen says, and then she goes on to say, the same kind of thing happened recently when Dr. Hoover published results about what he thought were past life particles or biology particles on Mars in the Journal of Cosmology. The blogosphere went crazy. The Journal of Cosmology was trashed as a bad journal. Hoover was ripped a good one. So my question is, given the venom that happens in the blogosphere with people who may or may not have credentials, willing to rip anyone and assassinate character on anyone for whatever theories they may publish, even if the theories are published in a journal such as Science, which is the case of the Mono Lake article, why would anyone want to publish, risk, go forward, and put forth anything new, given the abuse they are likely to sustain?
Oh, a reasonable question. One of the things that I've kind of come back to time and again as I look at astrobiology is that when major discoveries or purported discoveries are brought forward, there is initially, you know, great acclaim, and then there's a counter push and great criticism. And I go back to the Mars meteorite, and there are a number of other issues like that. And certainly what happened with Mono Lake would be in that category. I would say with Richard Hoover, things are slightly different. I also met with Dr. Hoover, and he is a very admirable and interesting person in many ways. I think it would be fair to say that that even some of the people close to him have a lot of doubts about the some of the methodology and some of the conclusions that he comes to. He's looking at meteorites that are not from Mars but from other places, and he's identifying through using an electron microscope what he says are microfossils. And I've looked with him through the electron microscope, and you see things that sure do look like they could, you know, that they were once living things, and he has done a number of has a number of lines of support, but the community as a whole doesn't feel that that he has backed it up in a way that is supportable. And for better or worse, I mean, you know, he is, his title is officially astrobiologist, and he works for NASA at the Marshall Space Center. But he, I would put into a somewhat different category to than what happened with Mono Lake and the science paper, because science is you know, very aggressively peer reviewed. The other journal is considerably less so, and. The folks involved in the science paper had the advantage of a lot more sophisticated technology to support some of what they said. So I admire Richard Hoover. You know, he's been working at this for a long time. But there is a great deal of skepticism about his conclusions. About the Mono Lake, you have a different phenomenon in that you have a really talented young woman who's leading the charge here, and it's going up against a lot of assumed wisdom, and it's not unreasonable that that it would be challenged, and you know that's kind of how science moves forward. This one became particularly venomous. And I think the nature of the blogosphere played some role in that. Perhaps the fact that she was a young woman played some role. Perhaps the fact that NASA presented this in a way that made people think that they were saying something different than what they were doing. Some people have accused them of kind of hyping things. That wasn't my impression, but you know, other people had that feeling. So I would put them into somewhat different categories, and you know, and in a different category, I would put Mike Mumma and the methane, because there, you know, there he has critics too, and people have published papers saying, you know, that this is right and this is wrong and whatever. But there was no kind of concerted serious pushback because his results were so, you know, kind of nailed down. And that's part of the difference between the how folks respond.
You have a caller on hold, but I think Ellen was more indicating being criticized for your work in theories is one thing, being character assassinated by the blogosphere is quite the other. So whether Hoover didn't have quite the peer review or the fact checking on than the science and Mono Lake story had. Neither of these people deserve to be blasted and character assassinated, and that's what the blogosphere does. So I think that is where Ellen, because I've heard this a lot on the space show, that's why I can surmise on her behalf. I think that's where she's coming from. You also see it in the new space community and in the space cadet, space enthusiast community. Man, if you don't march to my drum, it's not enough that we don't like your theory or idea. We're going to rip you a good one and assassinate your character every chance we get. So I think it's a problem in the space world, and I guess in the science world as well, too, to go after people individually, not just their ideas, which I always say are fair game. Ideas are fair game, sink or swim with the light of day shined on them. But people's character, nope, not fair game.
Yeah, no, I would agree with you, and I think that I wrote a story for the Post, both when the Mono Lake data came out, and then later after there was so much pushback, and as is, you know, what journalism is supposed to do, I talked to people on all different sides of it and gave their views. The people in the blogosphere felt that that this should not have been put forward the way that it was. But even the person who was kind of leading the charge ultimately said, not to me but to others, and then publicly, that she needed to apologize to the researchers for some of the personal attacks. So I think you're absolutely right that all the science is fair game, but to go after someone's personality and to just that character assassination is just very comfortable.
You know, another example of it is a couple of weeks ago, three very famous astronauts posted an open letter thinking that the Obama administration is killing sort of the Kennedy space legacy. You probably saw it. It appeared in USA Today. And the other day, Dennis Wingo, a very famous aerospace engineer and new space advocate and space commerce business guy with an impeccable reputation, good training from University of Alabama in Huntsville, posted an open letter back to the three astronauts. The first comment is attacking Dennis as a know-nothing, insignificant person, not worthy of giving a comment about Neil Armstrong, Gene Cernan, and Jim Lovell. And just ripping Dennis personally a good one. So it's one thing to disagree with Dennis's theory or what he's proposing in his open letter to the three astronauts. It's quite another thing to tear Dennis apart. There's nothing that Dennis has done to deserve that kind of rip. And I just think it's, when I get a chance to pontificate about it and rant about it on the space show, I do. And I've got Dennis coming back on the show in a couple of weeks. And that'll be a question I ask him. I'm sure he blew it off, which most of us do when it happens. But really, civility, you get a lot more with honey than you do with barbed wire, right?
Yeah, and I thought that generally speaking, the reporting about those three astronauts and the whole kind of demise of the Constellation project and how and why the Obama administration wanted to do what it did, I would kind of criticize my own profession because I don't feel that many people got deeply into it and instead would parrot what the astronauts or, in the case of some of the legislators who were clearly just protecting jobs back home. That's what it was about. And yet they would kind of put it into far more dignified language and say, the Obama administration is trying to ruin or has ruined the space program when, in fact, he's, I believe, moving it in a direction that an awful lot of people feel that it's essential that it move to.
Absolutely. Let's see who our caller is. And caller, did you stay with us? Are you still with us, please?
Yes, I am.
And you are, please.
Tim from Huntsville.
Hi, Tim. Speaking of Huntsville, how are you tonight?
I'm doing all right.
Go for it before your phone line breaks down.
Okay. I have a question about the prospect of having aliens coming and, quote-unquote, visit us. I'm not talking about UFOs, but more of an answer to the Fermi paradox of why you don't see them here.
Okay.
And one idea I had is that interstellar space, it's not completely empty. There's always these, microscopic or grain-sized specks floating around in between the stars. Now, at relativistic velocities, these can be very dangerous. Do you think this would make space travel, I mean, interstellar travel, virtually impossible for even relatively slow speeds, like a tenth or a 20th the speed of light. All right, I'll let you go.
Okay. Well, a little above my pay grade in terms of understanding that kind of physics. That wasn't what I was kind of focusing on, but I certainly will say that the laws of physics, as we discussed before, as we know them right now, wouldn't allow for that kind of travel. And since the distances are so great, the possibility, the fact that we, as far as we know, have not been visited, and there's really no, that is not scientifically sound one way or the other, because we just don't know if we've been visited. But in any case, that the distances are so unbelievably great, and the physics are what they are, so it's a paradox that doesn't strike me as being that hard to figure out.
Well, E.T. is waiting for me downstairs for dinner tonight, so they are here. But, you know, I have done shows with serious interstellar scientists, physicists, researchers. Mark Millis is one, and lots of people from the Tau Zero group, which is just first-rate think tank on advanced propulsion, advanced physics, interstellar travel. And in all of the shows I've done with these guys, with Mark and others, and Mark used to run the NASA Breakthrough Propulsion Group, I've never heard them say anything that would suggest any danger in doing interstellar travel based on what Tim was saying. Now, the next time Mark is on the show, or someone from Tau Zero comes on the show, and I'm sure that will happen this year because I have them on several times during the year and I really like those shows, I'm going to ask them about what Tim said. I've never heard it come up, and I'm clearly way beyond my pay grade too to even begin to offer an opinion on it, but I think it's really interesting, and I need to follow that up with Mark and some of the other guests that will be on the show that really do serious work and thinking about interstellar travel. Not that we can do it today, but who knows, maybe someday we will be able to.
Yeah, and I would look forward to, you know, getting people, to hearing people who know about this to talk about it, because it would be, goodness knows, it would be just a wonderful, remarkable breakthrough to be able to go at interstellar speed. And just kind of a final thought from me, there was a conference recently at MIT, and there were a lot of the top exoplanet people there, and there were also people from the commercial space industry. And the commercial space folks were saying, and perhaps it's some of the same folks that you just described, that that they did not think that it was impossible for some time in the future, perhaps distant future, but the future nonetheless, to have a mission to Alpha Centauri. That was something that from the theory that they had developed was possible. And again, you know, this is all being discussed kind of at one of the citadels of science, and who knows, maybe they'll be right.
Well, and I hope they do it in my lifetime, although I guess that's getting slimmer and slimmer, but you never know. Mark, this has been a fabulous, informative, fun, and really great discussion, and I'm glad we have had an opportunity to meet. Do you have another book in the works along the same lines?
No, not right now. There are a couple of other things that I have cooking, but there's not a next book yet. This one came out just in April, and so I've been going around and talking about it. And as I think I had mentioned to you, I was recently at the Hayden Planetarium in New York and at SETI Institute, and I'm going to be at the Smithsonian. And my perhaps favorite of all, there is something called the National Book Festival in Washington in September, and it's on the Mall. You know, hundreds of thousands of people come, and there's a quite small number of books that are selected by the Library of Congress to be there, and this, fortunately, is one of them. So if any of your listeners are in Washington and, you know, toward the end of September, they come down to the mall and say hello, and I'll be there talking about my book.
Do you put out an email address if people want to ask you questions, or do you want me to filter for you?
No, go right ahead. I have a website also. It's called HabitableZones.com.
I didn't know about that. Okay, .com, okay.
The email that I normally respond to is KaufmanM@washpost.com. That would be at the bottom of all my stories, so it's out there in public.
Okay. And now that you know about the space show, if you're doing some other interesting space articles or something and you want to talk about it out in the public, shoot me an email and let's do another show together. I'd enjoy that very much.
Terrific. I'd be delighted, and I thank you so much for having me.
Thank you very much. And listeners, that's it for tonight. Thank you for tuning in to Mark Kaufman and myself. And remember, his book is available on One Giant Leap Foundation's Amazon page. Buy it there. Amazon will contribute to the space show. And remember again, tomorrow night, an added special open lines program, 7 p.m. California time. On behalf of Mark Kaufman and myself in the space show, good night, everyone.